So, good morning. That's a hard act to follow, Seamus. It's a beautiful talk. So, well, what I want to talk about you this morning is talk to you about is our recent results on two experiments. So this will be like two 10-minute APS talks. The first experiment is on the thermal conductivity. These two experiments sort of address slightly different issues, and cuprates may be related, but on the surface they look very dissimilar. So thermal conductivity will be used to probe the quasi-particle excitations in very high purity IPCO grown in UBC. So this is the first topic, and it's been posted recently. Then I'm going to move to the Nernst effect and talk about what we believe are vortex-like excitations, not exactly the same kind of vortices that Seamus has been talking about, but maybe remnants way above TC in LSCO and which just appeared, and YBCO. So for the first experiment, this is on the thermal conductivity, and maybe I should, see, I thought the talk was 30 minutes, so I shortened the talk, and then I put the stuff back in, now I'm all confused. Okay, here it is. Just to remind you what thermal conductivity, well, the quasi-particles are, at least in the canonical conventional picture in the D wave, are mostly clustered around the nodes, which are in the pi-pi direction. And we would like to understand their properties because they represent the fundamental excitations. And this turns out to be a very tough goal because the Meissner current shields the quasi-particles extremely well. So you are left with detecting their heat current, their energy current. And there, of course, the Meissner current, since the condensate itself is zero entropy, is completely useless in shielding the quasi-particle. So we can actually detect their energy current, and that's what we're going to do. However, you encounter the problem of phonons. So phonons will flow, and especially in these beautiful crystals that are grown in BZO crucibles, the phonon conductivity dominates the quasi-particle current. And I think groups like Taillefer's group have gone down to very low temperatures to try to subtract out the phonons. What we'll do instead, since we're interested in sort of the high temperature properties, is to look at the thermal Hall effect. So in the thermal Hall effect, you apply a thermal gradient to excite the both the phonon and the charge current. And then you apply a magnetic field, and it turns out that the quasi-particles do suffer skew scattering from the vortices. And this leads to a very large Hall current in the transverse direction. And you know that's true because when you invert the field, if previously this edge was warmed up by the quasi-particles, that edge becomes cooler when you invert the field. So phonons being neutral don't do that, and therefore this gives you a filter to really focus on the quasi-particles. Right? So the penalty is that the experiments are harder. But in the last 3 or 4 years, we have improved the resolution quite a bit. But the biggest change, improvement, were these new crystals, which have extremely long mean free paths, and they have more or less sort of triple or maybe quadruple the signal or level. And I'm going to show you the results in a minute. So again, the experiment is apply a thermal gradient here and apply a magnetic field and look for the transverse thermal gradient as the skew scattered quasi-particles cool the edge that they're headed for. Now, the inset here shows the improvement in the raw zero field thermal conductivity. And the profile is very well known by now. The open circles are the previous best crystals. These were Taillefer's crystals on twin, grown on yttria-stabilized zirconia, which was the previous best crucible. But because of residual yttrium impurities, zirconium impurities, the thermal anomaly gets to be about factor of 2 larger than in a normal state. In these new crystals grown on BZO, barium zirconate, which doesn't dissolve in the flux, the mean free path is quite a bit larger. And some of this improvement comes from phonons, obviously. So the idea is to use the experiment to try to determine what are the phonons and what are the quasi-particles. And you can see that even the zero field data already looks quite amazing. It jumps by a factor of two. Now, the main panel shows the thermal Hall current. So so everyone's familiar with sigma xy. So just imagine this is sigma xy, except we are looking at the energy current instead of the charge current, right? Versus the magnetic field, and I've anti-symmetrized the signal for you so that this is just looking at what we believe to be the intrinsic thermal conductivity. So there are no phonon terms here. Everything you see here, this is essentially raw data, represents an electronic current, the energy of the electronic current below TC. And the first thing you note is the very large enhancement of the signal. 85 Kelvin, we're below TC. This is on a slightly overdoped YBCO crystal, 6.993. So it's slightly overdoped. TC is about 87 Kelvin, thereabouts. But even below TC, it's not very different from the normal state here. But as soon as you go slightly below, you start picking up a enhancement of the initial slope, which we'll focus on in this part of the talk, and then it grows rapidly. All right, so I don't want to spend too much time on the analysis. So I'll just show you a quick scan of data. When you go below the temperature 40 Kelvin, where the signal is largest, the slope now becomes so steep that it's beyond our resolution, basically. So these experiments are done point-wise because we have to stabilize the field and take the sample the measurements a number of times. So you can track this the initial slope at various temperatures, and using the simplest model that we can think of, which is the Drude model, we can then extract the lifetime, the mean free path. Right. So this is the first part of the talk. The lifetime is plotted here as a mean free path, or equivalently as a Hall angle. Right? So Hall angle is just omega c tau, so it's linear in the lifetime, linear in the mean free path. I've made the translation for you there. The thing to note is it grows very rapidly below TC and gets to values of about a micron. It gets too long for our method to work. It turns out that the Hall method doesn't work well below 10 Kelvin. So these are very long mean free paths, and that's one of the issues which I hope we'll have some discussion here. Why are the mean free paths so long in cuprates when you don't have impurity scattering or when it's not a major effect? And why does the mean free path change so abruptly below TC? So this, many of you will recall, is in rather serious disagreement with ARPES. So ARPES has now obtained resolution sufficiently high to start addressing quasi-particle issues. And the first result that we get is that there's no change in lifetime in BISCO as you go down TC. So this is in very strong disagreement with transport. And it would be nice to understand what the issues are. So this graph sort of summarizes the two anomalies that the two issues that I wanted to bring to your attention. Now, we've tried various ways to analyze the results. The simplest way is to try to do scaling, and there was a scaling equation that Simon and Lee proposed about 5 years ago, and that works pretty well up to the temperatures above which the scaling argument breaks down. So if you look at temperatures below about 30 Kelvin, all the curves collapse after you do the scaling to what we believe to be the universal curve below that holds for thermal Hall conductivity. The new feature here, which of course the theory did not address, is that it's linear in square root of h. You know, all the curves appear to collapse to a linear behavior at weak fields. So this was not anticipated by the scaling theory, and I feel that this probably is an issue that is important for that may be of interest for the discussion later this week. And that's whether Landau quantization occurs in this for the nodal states. Now, I think maybe all the authors are here. There's a big controversy about whether in an intense magnetic field the quasi-particle states are Landau quantized. So the experiments are starting to address this issue. I think with further improvements in the thermal Hall conductivity, one can actually extract the thermal Hall conductivity and compare with predictions based on theories that fall on one or the other side of this this question. Okay. So to summarize the first part of the talk, this is the scaling relationship that Patrick and Steve Simon proposed. That the at low enough temperatures, the thermal Hall conductivity normalized by T squared should just obey a universal function of square root of h over T. And so what the experiment has done is to empirically define for you this scaling function, which of course theory cannot produce yet. And the finding, as I've noted, is that f sub xy is linear in its argument, and that I think wasn't anticipated in the calculation. And that's rather puzzling, actually, why should be linear. That means it goes up like a square root of h, which is, of course, totally at variance with what one might expect from a Hall response. A Hall response must be linear in h, right, in weak fields. But it appears to be proportional to the square root of h. So in summary, you see a very large increase in the thermal conductivity, and this corresponds to a thousandfold. Actually, this is the one point that I forgot to mention. But if you take the initial slope of the thermal Hall current, and follow its temperature dependence, the increase is a factor of 1,000, which is the largest increase in any transport property in the cuprates that I know of. And this is all driven by this very strong enhancement of the lifetime as soon as you get below TC. So this 1,000-fold increase is specific to these new generation of crystals. The zero field mean free path increases by a factor of 100 to about a 1 micron. And I already alluded to this disagreement between transport and RPAS about the behavior of the lifetime below TC. And I talked briefly about Simon Lee scaling below 30 Kelvin. So for the discussion later this week, the issues are, well, I already mentioned this. Right. So the long lifetime, the abrupt change below TC, and the nature of the quasi particle excitations is in fact a Landau level quantization. Does it exist? And what's the actual quasi particle state? Everything I showed here is for the optimal doping.
That's right.
But the 60 Kelvin crystals show fairly similar behavior. Then there are certain differences in the thermal content, but not of any consequence for what I mentioned.
Yeah,
just
the screen. Transport
in the optics, which may not be the same here. Yeah, but the trend is the same. The trend in the disco is the same. Yeah. That's right. But when you do the thermal Hall effect, the change in the initial slope is very abrupt. So. Right. But the mean free path doesn't get as long. That's why the kappa xx peak is not pronounced. So the numbers are 400 angstroms for this one, as compared to a micron here. That's right. No, but the change in scope is yeah. Well, these numbers, of course, are much longer than what RPAS is able to get right now, right? So Peter Johnson's best resolution is 100 angstroms.
But that's not the issue, really. In their measurement, they are seeing 24 angstroms, which is abysmally short from our point of view. So that's where the problem is.
They have an energy resolution of 20 millivolts.
Yeah, this is a separate issue, that's right. Yeah, but they claim that if it had been 100 angstroms, they would have seen it. And they do see it in pendulum by Salomon. So the second part of my 10-minute talk presentation, second part is the Nernst effect. So we were motivated by theoretical papers that address whether in a phase coherence drives TC and so on, and the beautiful experiment of Ornstein that appeared about a year ago, showing that if fluctuations were there, they should see it in the kinetic inductors at terahertz frequencies. And they said that, well, they can certainly see it up to only 24 or 25 Kelvin in two samples of this one. Now, we wanted to look for this by using DC transport. And we sort of backed ourselves into it because we weren't really looking for it. We're looking at the Nernst effect. And we kept seeing this enormous background, the Nernst effect above TC, that we tried to subtract. But it turned out to be the most interesting part of the experiment. So the idea is the following. If there are vortices, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Raise it higher.
Yeah. It was also upside down.
Turn it off. Can you hear me? How's that?
That's good.
Great. So again, we're applying a thermal gradient down the crystal, but this time, instead of looking for the thermal or the energy current in a transverse direction, we simply look for the electric field, right? The idea being that if vortices exist and they drift down the gradient, because you can think of them as packets of entropy that we'd like to seek out the colder part of the sample, then by the Josephson equation B cross V, they will generate an electric field transverse to their velocity. And when you put numbers in, this electric field is much, much larger than what you would expect from ordinary carriers. Ordinary carriers will do the same thing, but their major effect is in generating the thermal power. And that's the big signal. If they have a Hall angle, which of course they do, they will also generate an electric field in the same direction, in the transverse direction, but that's very tiny. So that's down from the thermal power, at least by the Hall angle, right? And I'm going to show you later that, in fact, it's worse than that. There is a cancellation that I call the Sonheimer cancellation, which the referees did not like, /. So anyway, there's a cancellation first pointed out by Sonheimer that further reduces that signal. Okay, so that's the... And these experiments were actually pioneered by many groups. Rick Green's group did a lot of work in the about 6 years ago. This says the same thing. All right, so that's the experimental configuration. Now, this is not a Faraday effect. This is not, you know, d phi dt generates an electric field, because the flux density is always uniform and constant in time. So this is really a signature of the Josephson equation. It's phase slip, right? Every time you have a 2 pi phase slip, you generate a chemical potential difference between the electrodes. And the way that experimentalists analyze this is to say that, well, you have a force, a driving force, which is the gradient of the entropy density. So you have F equals S phi grad T. And then you have a phenomenological damping term, which involves the Bardeen-Stephen viscosity eta. So you balance the two forces, and so when you form the Nernst coefficient, which is the transverse electric field that you get per unit field applied per unit gradient, you get these two parameters. The entropy per line has some microscopic meaning. The viscosity, perhaps less so, is just a phenomenological term. So in LSCO, well, the data just came out, so I'm just going to quickly run through it. You see a very large signal. This is now the Nernst signal versus field. You see a large signal below TC, and that's not surprising. This has been done by many groups. But when you go above TC, so this is an underdoped LSCO sample grown by Uchida's group. At 35 Kelvin, which is now above TC, the signal is not very much smaller, not appreciably smaller than at TC. And it persists up to about 140 Kelvin, where it slowly merges into the negative background that we identify with the normal state Nernst coefficient. So this was the background that we were trying to get rid of. And it was always there in all samples of LSCO that we looked at. Now, when you look at YBCO in optimum doped, these are the kinds of experiments that have been done about 7 years ago. You don't see this. The signal is large in the resistive state, but once you get above TC, let's say 92 Kelvin, it rapidly collapses. By 98 Kelvin, it's zero. Okay, so I don't want to give the impression that you know, this signal is all over the place. In an optimum dope, it's been known for many years that it's not there above TC. Now, what happens when you underdope? That's the last part of my talk. So back to LSCO, we now track this signal down, and TC for all these samples, TC cluster down here, right below 35 Kelvin. So this is at very high magnification. This is something like a factor of 100 higher than what previous studies had done. And you see that the signal comes down. It's linear in field within in all these temperature ranges. And so I'm just plotting the slope, which is the Nernst coefficient. It comes down and it then saturates in what we believe to be the normal state value. So if one would identify this enhancement as coming from vortices or vortex-like excitations, then it's very surprising, right? It's a striking result because you're forced into saying that, well, TC for this sample, let's say 0.10, is about 30 Kelvin, but you have these excitations persisting to 120, 130 Kelvin. What's worse, in 0.05, TC is below 4 Kelvin, but throughout the temperature range that I'm showing here, you do see the signal, right? So one has to contend with that. Well, if these are indeed fluctuations, why do they persist such high temperatures? And they cannot be due to clusters of optimum dope LSCO, because that only brings you to 30, 35 Kelvin. So something else is happening there. This shows the data on log scale, and you can see that in the Abrikosov state, the signal is always between 1 and 4 microvolts per Kelvin Tesla, and it rapidly decreases for the optimum dope sample, but has this very long tail that persists up to very high temperatures. Here I've subtracted off the background nu sub zero that we identify with a normal state. Yeah. It's not superconducting. TC is not at 4 Kelvin or higher. But now if we extrapolate this down to where it hits 1 microvolt, it probably may superconduct at 1 Kelvin. But we don't go below 4 Kelvin for these experiments. All right, what about the normal state? So let me just quickly address that question. So normal charge carriers, when you impose a thermal gradient, will drift, right, because of the thermal power effect. They will drift, if there are holes, they will drift to the right and then set up a back EMF that cancels further drift. And that gives you the thermal power, right? If they have a Hall response, which they do, then one can show that this drift, the electric field, which is now pointing in the other direction, will generate a electrical Hall current that moves the thermal the carriers to the top edge in this field configuration. So this is what you obtain from multiplying the thermal power by the Hall angle, right? But this is only half the story. It turns out that there is the Peltier conductivity, which I've labeled by alpha, that is the electric current generated by a thermal gradient. Now, that also picks up an off-diagonal component, which is alpha xy. And that you can show always leads to the opposite sign. So that will bring carriers, because the thermal gradient, remember, is pointing to my right. That will bring carriers down, these are the same carriers, down to the bottom edge. And therefore, as far as the signal, the electric field is concerned, these two currents in the Hall direction will tend to cancel. So more formally, this is what Sonnheimer did. The electrical current along the y direction is the familiar sigma xy plus the Peltier off-diagonal conductivity. And these are the two large terms that always are opposed in direction. Right? So the absence of cancellation will then be observed by us as a Nernst effect coming from the ordinary carriers. So setting this to zero, we can solve for E sub y, and that generates two terms. So what I'm going to do now is to measure independently one of them. You can't measure both because, well, that's exactly what you're doing when you do the Nernst effect. But this term you can measure independently because if you stare at it, it's just the Hall angle times the thermal power. So I'm saying this in a slightly more formal fashion. The total current is the sum of these two currents. And then once you put in the boundary conditions, you find that you have two terms here. And E sub x is, of course, just determined by the thermal power, which you do measure separately, right? So the carrier Nernst effect is the sum of the thermal power term plus this Peltier term. All right, so I've repeated the equation here, and the solid symbols represent the one of the partners, one of these terms. Because thermal power and Hall angle, of course, can be measured independently. And you see that this has to cancel another term that's equally large but opposite in sign to generate the observed electric field. Right? So the cancellation is about one part in 30. All right, so to repeat the point, you can think of the normal state Nernst effect as the observed thermal power multiplied by the Hall angle, but that's only half the story because even though this term is small, it's further cancelled by the Peltier current, which further reduces it by another factor of 10. So in the cuprates, we believe the background effect is actually very small, at most 10 nanovolts per Kelvin per Tesla. And so this diverging term must be something else. And these are these vortex-like excitations that we have reported. But let me do another test experimentally. We've taken these Kankwada-type samples, again grown by the Tokyo group, doped with neodymium, and that induces the structural transition, the LTT-LTO transition, below which stripes start to appear. You have charge ordering followed by spin ordering. Right? So the current interpretation is that these are static stripes, very bad for superconductivity. In fact, if you look at the Meissner signal, the superconductivity is pushed from 25 Kelvin down below 8 Kelvin. It's probably all fluctuation superconductivity. It's very hard to do anything meaningful in transport for these crystals. But anyway, here's a sample that is nominally identical to the undoped material, except superconductivity is suppressed. When you compare the two, right, the open symbols are the neodymium-free LSCO. That's the divergence I've been talking about. But once you trigger the LTT transition, this is gone. Right? So at least up to the structural transition, we can say that when superconductivity is killed by static stripe formation, so is this signal. So this gives us some support that indeed we're looking at fluctuation-induced excitations, probably vortices in a normal state. All right, so this is a test that already has appeared. So finally, we can now look at the contour. How much time do you have left?
15 minutes.
Oh, okay, good. 10 minutes. So this is the contour.
When you suppress TC by removing strontium, then the effect was still there at high temperatures.
Removing strontium. You mean going under dope?
Yeah, when you went to 0.05, the signal
starts right,
to fade
right,
up there.
Right.
And then you put the neodymium in, which suppresses TC, and then the signal goes away.
Right.
So, but doesn't the first one say that it's not associated with superconductivity because it's practically gone in those
signals? No. What we would interpret that as is that the strength of the pairing may in fact be very large as you go towards the pairing compound.
I mean, it seems to me if you on the basis, you reduce TC through two different mechanisms. One of them, the signal went away.
Well, we're not.
Stayed there.
Are you reducing TC? That's the issue. Or is this just a phase coherence temperature? Yeah. So the contour plot of the signal, now I've subtracted off the normal state background. So this is the divergent part of the Nernst signal. And as Tom just pointed out, the contours suggest, this is now just on the divergent part. See, the contours suggest that actually there's a tendency to grow as you go towards underdoping. And in fact, the Meissner signal, so remember, when we look at TC and we report it in the literature, what we are reporting is the Meissner signal, right? Because that's all we can see. It can say that there's long-range phase coherence that kicks in at TC. So that is the point that I guess you were making. Okay, what about YBCO? So we have taken a series of crystals, some of them twin, some of them untwin, some of them quenched, some of them annealed. So there's an assortment of different treatments. They give the same results that I'm going to report here. All right, so these are some of the crystals that we've done. Now, the story is actually slightly longer for YBCO, so I'm going to walk through this in several steps. This is the signal, the raw signal from 6.45. So YBCO, let me remind you, the nail temperature goes to zero at 6.4. But the doping density is not zero. This I'll come back to where we have proposed a new way to determine the doping density. 6.40 is roughly 0.05 in doping. And the TC rises very steeply from zero, and that's where the nail temperature drops to zero, right? So 6.45, so 0.06 in doping. And the known signal is very large. The TC is probably 30 Kelvin. It's 30 Kelvin for this crystal. But you see, when you go above that, the signal persists. The known signal persists all the way to 140 Kelvin. However, if you go to 6.66, this is an underdoped YBCO crystal, and according to our new calibration, this has a density of 0.18, way beyond what we would call optimum doping in LSCO. The known signal is large in the below TC, but it goes negative once you go above TC. So this is a complication that YBCO brings, and that's what's been stalling this experiment for the last 6 months. Anyway, so let me walk you through the Nernst signal step by step. Here is a crystal at 6.40, roughly 0.05 in doping. And the magnetization is not the sharpest in the crystals we've grown, but it's fairly good. It's gone by 30 Kelvin, but look at this tail. I mean, it's this time plotted on linear scale to emphasize the high temperature part. It persists all the way to 140 Kelvin before it merges with the normal state background. As you move up in doping, it gets slightly larger. Again, this is a crystal with normally 30 Kelvin transition, fairly sharp, but now the fluctuation persists up to 140 Kelvin again before it merges there. 6.50. This is a ortho 2 that was grown, kindly supplied by Doug Bond to us. And we have attached leads to it without your permission. Doug, are you here? Right, so not your head. Yeah, bad boy. We attached leads to it, and it shows more or less the same behavior, but this time the transition's at 50 Kelvin, and the fluctuations persist all the way to a slightly lower temperature, 120 Kelvin. Ortho 2, by the way, means that every other chain is intact, right? And the correlation length is about 150 microns. So these are fairly good untwinned crystals. 5 minutes. Let me just speed up. All right, so let me just skip over the negative part. The upshot of this is that LSCO and YBCO can be put more or less on the same same plot. I guess the effect didn't come out as clearly as I hoped. The ones with color are LSCO that just appeared in print. The ones in black are YBCO, but don't try to follow the curves here. What I wanted to stress was that the same trend appears until you hit 6.66, and then it becomes very abrupt thereafter. You get very abrupt vanishing of the Nernst signal. But below 6.66, it more or less is a continuation of LSCO. Now, to get this new calibration that I alluded to, we decided to revisit the thermal power because we felt that there have been a lot of different ways to understand to derive the carrier density in YBCO in the plane, none of which was terribly convincing. So let me just show you one, perhaps that may be just slightly less convincing. What we have done here is taken the whole slew of LSCO crystals with doping that one, what everyone accepts, right? Because the number of strontium impurities is the number of carriers in a plane. So the LSCO data are shown in yellow, and this serves as our template. Then we impose the thermal power of YBCO crystals without adjusting anything on top of it, and you can now identify compounds that have nominally the same thermal power. Right? Whether you wish to identify further that they have the same hole density, well, that depends on interpretation. But let me show you, for example, 6.4 is surely very close to 0.07. I guess I call it the wrong number, right? It's 0.07. 6.5, the ortho 2, is 0.10 in the plane. And so on and so forth. And you find that there might be some that deviate, but by and large, this gives you a way to anchor the carrier density from one material to the other. And the results are actually quite surprising when you put this on a phase diagram plot. So first of all, let me show you the calibration further. This is the X in LSCO that matches the Y in YBCO. And you can see that above the nail temperature, it's linear. Every oxygen atom you put into the YBCO delivers 0.4 holes to the planes. This doesn't count the chain contribution. And it's in good agreement with data from Uchida et al., who used unitary scattering of zinc to do the same calibration, except for this little wiggle here. It looks like it's in pretty good agreement with the zinc data, but in very bad agreement with a recent calibration, for example, from Alul's group, where they use the Gorkov-Abrikosov suppression of TC as one of their inputs to calibrate YBCO. Now, why am I making a big fuss about this? Well, if you go to this calibration, you will say that optimum dope YBCO has a carrier density of 0.17. And that makes the theorists very happy because everything's on the same phase diagram. But this is not experimentally correct, we believe. All right, so I'm going to come back to this point. Are you going to turn off my projector? All right. Okay. I'm almost done. So here's the new doping. Here's the new doping. Optimum doping, well, if one can still call that optimum doping in LSCO, does not match optimum doping in YBCO. And this has been known since the early work of Uchida, but somehow it's never been made a big, never considered to be a critical. Optimum 0.15 corresponds to 60 Kelvin YBCO, and so this looks like a pure single layer cuprate. And what I've put on here are the stressed film results from Sato et al. Recently. When he grows the film stressed, the bulk result is much lower than the stressed film result. And this curve is now reproduced in red. So you can sort of see that LSCO, when stressed, is sort of moving towards the YBCO result. All right, now why am I making a big fuss about this? Because this accounts for why the Nernst signal in the two materials are very similar, provided you have calibrated the whole density correctly. So below 0.15, 0.16, the Nernst contours match fairly well, except that in YBCO, TC is pushed up to what we believe to be the intrinsic single layer value. Right. Now, what happens above that? Well, that's probably chain states, interlayer tunneling, and so on. That we haven't really addressed. But this statement says that the phase diagram of the two materials do not mesh as easily as we would like, at least as the theorists would like. And this perhaps merits some discussion. I am done. Let me just put up the issues then as a summary of the talk. So in the second part of the talk, I discussed pairing fluctuations and evidence for that, what's the nature of the excitations, and this new calibration that we feel at least merges the results, experimental results between the two compounds. Thank you. No, pseudo gap is a factor of 2 higher. Yeah. But the trend looks the same with doping. Yeah.
That was my question too. You got this weird effect.
It's real. It's not weird. It's real. It's not weird.
You have this effect. Where does it end?
Well,
where would you say it's not anomalous anymore?
When it merges with the normal state background.
So, where is that?
Well, okay, then it's a question of experimental resolution, right? So we can resolve 1 nanovolt per Kelvin per Tesla, and so we have conservatively put a 5 nanovolt resolution window. So anything below 5 nanovolts, we don't make a big fuss.
At what doping does the effect become negligible?
For which system? For LSCO, we still see it at 0.2. But in YBCO, we don't. Okay, then the negative anomaly, which I didn't have time to go over, kicks in at 6.7, and then it becomes hard to extract.
John?
Well, we're not talking about long-range phase coherence for these experiments, right? We're talking, you know, I don't know what the domain size over which the these vortex excitations last in order, what length scale is needed in order to produce, say, a nanovolt signal. We're not so there's no phase coherence over the whole sample. The Meissner effect is gone. It's completely zero.
I think your time scale.
Well, if you need them to last at least long enough
to cross the
right. some finite distance,
right.
let's say a lattice case, and you get a time scale for that.
We haven't. We have. I think it's very short. It's very short.
It's a particle excitation. You cannot destroy it in the middle of the system. It just has to go from one end.
No, but they're saying that if the condensate disappears on you, right? If it disappears on you, then
but it can disappear only because of proliferation of work exactly.
No, there's no condensate left. There's no condensate left. So a patch of a sample has no condensate. So it's
one more question.
Yeah, have you thought about just to the result of your own science experiment?
Yeah.
Did you find
We haven't started the BISCO studies yet. That's next on the agenda. Well, as you see, we've been mostly worried about YBC over the last 6 months. But actually, there are BISCO data already out there. 90 Kelvin BISCO has a very long tail as well. This actually has been known for 7 years. Now, when we go back to the literature, Clay Hole tells me that he's always seen it, but just ignored it. Optimum dope BISCO has known signal extending up to 125 Kelvin.
But wouldn't that mean that it's acting with prediction? Because due in
to?
The dope systems, you have, but your own science experiment showed that the signal basically vanished at 25 Kelvin above
TDP. Right, so we would.
You would expect that in the optimal dope system, it should decay even more rapidly.
Yeah. Well, we're not prepared to say one way or the other until we finish the experiments. But that's a good suggestion.
Just one more question.
I think it's possible that you conceivable that your experiment is more sensitive to vortices than Joe's experiment, because I think all you need is little patches of superinductor that live for a little while and for some vortices to move a little distance, whereas Joe is seeing some average. So I think in some sense it's complementary. So it may not be a contradiction, but I think we need to think harder about it.
Thank you.